Thomas L. Friedman is a 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times. He's a perfect author to tell us what's happening to the world in a way that we can understand. He has covered OPEC and the oil-related news. He has served as chief diplomat at the White House, and he has been an international correspondent, graduate of Oxford, degrees in Mediterranean studies. Today's featured author is Thomas L. Friedman with his recent book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Hi, I'm Elaine Petrocelli, and I am thrilled that Thomas Friedman has flown up here just to talk to you here at Book Passage today.
I know some of you have read Hot, Flat, and Crowded already. Those of you who haven't, I know who you are, okay? I know who you are, what bookstore you frequent, and but those of you who haven't read it, or those who have, you know, I always like to begin by saying this book looks like a book about energy and environment, but quite honestly, it just masquerades as a book about energy and environment. It's really a book about America, and I really use energy and environment as an allegory, really, for the great challenge facing us and whether we as a country can continue to rise to meet great challenges. And that's really what the book is about. So for those interested in energy and environment, I invite you to read it because I think it delves deeply and I hope intelligently into those issues. But I even more urge you to read it for those of you who are really interested in America today and why we've lost our groove. Because that's really what the book is about. It's why we've lost our groove as a country and how and why I think we can get it back. So I actually start the book. If you'd go to the first slide, please. This is a billboard, and I'll read it to all those who can't see it in back. This is a billboard that appeared in South Africa last year. It was an advertisement for the Daimler Smart 4-4 car. And the billboard said, German engineering, Swiss innovation, American nothing. And that's the actual billboard. Someone actually thought that the best way to advertise a product to a South African audience was to advertise that it had American nothing inside. That billboard pisses me off, okay? It pisses me off for several reasons. One, I think it's wrong, but two, it also saddens me that people would actually think that. And it is about, a reflection of the extent we've lost our groove that people would actually advertise American nothing. So this book about energy environment, actually begins as a result in a very strange place. It begins post 9/11. Actually begins in Istanbul, Turkey, because the first reason I think we've lost our groove has to do with kind of what we've become and how we've been acting as a country since 9/11, getting much more into the business of exporting our fears, and not exporting our hopes. So the book begins on a trip I took to Istanbul in 2003. I was going to visit the U.S. Consul General in Istanbul. Our consulate in Istanbul used to be located in the very heart of the city amid the mosques and the bazaars. Turks could easily drop in. And I had arranged right after I arrived from the airport, I would go to our consulate and meet with the Consul General. So I came from from the airport right to my hotel, dropped off my bags, told the driver to take me to the consulate, and he said, the consulate's moved. I said, it's moved? My God, where did it go? He said, it's moved to a suburb, Istinia, which is about 45 minutes from the city center. I said, oh, my God, let's go. You know, I'm going to be late. We drove out to Istinia, and there on a bluff overlooking the Bosphorus, I beheld the new U.S. consulate in Istanbul. It is a maximum security prison. San Quentin has nothing on it. 15-foot high walls, a barbed wire, guard towers. It basically said to the Turkish visitor, go away. Go away. All visitors welcome. Go away. I got inside. I sat down with our consul general. I said, Jesus, you guys could have filmed the Turkish prison movie Midnight Express here, okay? And he said, well, I got to tell you, there's a lot of American diplomats who are alive today because of those high walls. 6 months earlier, Turkish terrorists had blown up the British consulate in Istanbul, which used to be located next door to our old one, killed the British consul, killed 30 other people, wounded 400. And afterwards, Turkish police captured one of those Turkish terrorists, and they interrogated him. And he told them that their group really wanted to blow up the new U.S. consulate, but it was so secure, they don't even let birds fly there. And the first chapter of this book is called Where Birds Don't Fly. Because where birds don't fly, people don't mix. Ideas don't get exchanged. Friendships don't get forged. Collaboration doesn't happen. Freedom doesn't ring. Now, do not get me wrong. I understand, and those who read me understand, that we have real enemies. We have real enemies, and unfortunately, we do need consulates with high walls today, and we do need metal detectors. I would actually go through 16 metal detectors when I leave here in a couple hours at San Francisco Airport under one condition, that on the other side of the last metal detector would be a great project worthy of the inspirational prowess and innovative capacity of the United States of America and not just another metal detector. And that's really what's been bothering me these past few years. We are not the United States of fighting terrorism. That's not who we are. I weep and I truly mourn for everyone who was killed on 9/11. But for me, 9/11 is still just the day between 9/10 and 9/12. My day is the 4th of July. 9/11 was about them. The 4th of July is about us. And we need to get back to being the people of the 4th of July and not the people of post-9/11. And that's the first reason I think we've lost our groove and what we need to do to get it back. Second reason we've lost our groove is we lost our competitor. Everybody needs a competitor. I mean, what would Book Passage be without Barnes & Noble? I mean, really, you know, just a lot richer is what they would be. So we all need a competitor, and New York Times needs the Washington Post. We had the Soviet Union, and unfortunately, we lost our competitor. I mean, fortunately, we lost our competitor for the people of the Soviet Union. But when we did, we got a little fat, dumb, and lazy, frankly, as a country. Not in terms of business. You know, the world went flat, I believe, after the Soviet Union collapsed, and multinational American companies had actually become hyper-competitive. But as a government, you know, our system kind of won. And we kind of fell into this mode of what I call dumb as we want to be. Dumb as we want to be, and we'll get to it when we get to it. And that leads to the third reason I think we've lost our groove, and that has to do with the fact that our government doesn't work anymore. And I'm not here to make cheap and easy points about the government in Washington not working. That's shooting fish in a barrel. But there actually is a serious issue here. Our government today cannot solve any big multi-generational problem. And whether it's called energy, environment, healthcare, social security, it just doesn't seem to work anymore. It has to do with gerrymandered political districts, money in politics, 24-hour news cycles, and a permanent presidential campaign that have come together in a way to simply gridlock politics in Washington. And it's been very striking to me. I've been on book tour now for 7 weeks. I've been all across this great country. Particularly when I speak at universities, I'm really struck that I come back from my lectures at night, go to my hotel room, and empty my pockets because they're full of business cards. Business cards from energy entrepreneurs and people doing wind, solar, cellulosic. I meet the craziest people. I've got a duck, it paddles a wheel, blows up a balloon, issues methane, turns a turbine, creates electricity. I hear the craziest stuff, okay? But what it tells me is that our country is alive today with innovation and entrepreneurship exploding from the ground up. But we do not have a government in Washington today that is maximizing and channeling and nurturing that energy. In fact, if I were to draw a picture of America today, it would be a picture of the space shuttle taking off. You've seen the space shuttle take off. All this incredible thrust coming from below. But in our case, the booster rocket, Washington, D.C., is cracked and leaking energy. And the pilots in the cockpit are fighting over the flight plan. And as a result, we as a country cannot achieve escape velocity. We can't achieve escape velocity to get into the next orbit. The next great industrial revolution, which I call ET, energy technology, which I believe is going to be the next great global industry because the world is getting Hot, Flat, and Crowded. So what is this Hot, Flat, and Crowded all about? And how does it relate then to America? Well, the basic argument I have is that what red was to America in the 1950s, anti-communism, this all-encompassing idea around which we built our roads and railroads and highways and missile defense and education and universities, all to face the Soviet Union. What red was to America in the 1950s, green needs to be to America of the 21st century. Unfortunately, after 9/11, we went from red to code red, and we now really need to go from red to code green. And that's really what this book is about. Why and how? So what is this Hot, Flat, and Crowded all about? Let's get back into it. Well, hot refers to global warming, the fact that global average temperatures have risen almost 1 degree centigrade and 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, heading for 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1750, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Now, I know what you're thinking. I've given this talk before. You're thinking, you mean all that Al Gore stuff is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit? That's right. It actually is, because the global climate system is actually a lot like your body. If your body temperature goes from 98.6 to 100.6, you don't feel so good. And if you go from 100.6 to 102.6, you go to the hospital. So does Mother Nature. Small changes in global average temperature can have huge climate effects. That's hot. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Flat is my metaphor for the rise of middle classes all over the world, from China to India, from Brazil to Russia, who are increasingly living, driving, and consuming like America. The truth is, friends, there are too many Americans in the world today. Of course, I'm being facetious. It's a blessing that so many people can now consume and live in American-style homes, American-style cars, American-size Big Mac. But the good Lord did not design this planet for this many Americans. And as a result, unless we, the original Americans, redefine what it means to be an American in sustainability terms, and invent the tools so many more people can be Americans, if we don't do that, we are going to heat up, choke up, and devour up this planet so much more quickly than anybody realizes with this many Americans. That's what flat is about. Crowded is about population growth. We're in the year 2008. By the year 2020 or thereabouts, the early 2020s, there's going to be another billion people on this planet. That's in just 12 years. You know, if you go to Google and you put in your birthday and hit I'm feeling lucky, you can find out how many people were on the planet the year you were born. So I was born July 20, 1953. I put that into Google. I hit I'm feeling lucky, and it told me there were 2.681 billion people on the planet the year I was born. Today, there are 6.2 billion. If I go to the UN charts on their population page and project out to 2053, if I keep working out, eating yogurt, and live to be 100, it tells me that in 2053, there will be 9.2 billion people on the planet. What that means is that in my lifetime, the population of the planet is going to more than triple, and there are going to be more people actually born between now and when I die in 2053 than were here when I was born. So the world is getting hot, flat, and crowded. And what I'm basically arguing is hot, flat, and crowded were like three separate flames that came together right around the millennium, actually, to create a huge fire. And this fire is now driving five key global trends. And these five trends, and I'll read them off for those in the back, I believe shape and determine the 21st century. How and whether we meet the challenge of these five trends is going to be the ball game for the 21st century. So let's go through them. The first is called Energy and Natural Resource Supply and Demand. I call that chapter in my book, Too Many Americans Are Carbon Copies, because they are our carbon copies. And what the chapter is about is what happens when flat meets crowded, when so many more people can live like Americans. Now, one of the fun things about my job and what I get to do is people send me stuff all the time. And I have some wonderful collaborators out there who know what I'm interested in. One of them is Dave Douglas, who is the Chief Sustainability Officer at Sun Microsystem. He was noodling around one day and he emailed me. He said, I was sitting back and thinking, you know, we're going to be another billion people here between 2008 and 2020. What would happen, said Dave, if we gave each of the next billion people just one 60-watt incandescent light bulb? After all, everybody should have a light bulb. Here's what would happen. Each bulb doesn't weigh much, said Dave, roughly 0.7 ounces with the packaging, but a billion of them weighs together around 20,000 metric tons, or the same as 15,000 Toyota Priuses. Now let's turn them on. If they're all on at the same time, that would be 60,000 megawatts. Luckily, they will only use their bulbs, the next billion, 4 hours a day, so we're down to 10,000 megawatts at any moment. Yikes, says Dave. That means we will need to build 20 new 500-megawatt coal-burning power plants just so the next billion people can each turn on one light bulb 4 hours a day. That's what happens when flat meets crowded. Another example I like to give: when I was working on the book, I visited two cities you may have never heard of. You certainly can be excused if you haven't. One is called Doha, Qatar, the capital of Qatar, a small peninsular state off the east coast of Saudi Arabia in the Persian Gulf. It's where the U.S. Middle East Military Command is located. I was going to Iraq last September while I was working on the book, and I've been a frequent visitor to Qatar over the years, but I had not been there in 3 years. Flew directly from Washington to Qatar, landed at the airport, was met by friends in the government, drove directly into downtown Doha at night. I looked around and I said, "That's Manhattan. You sprouted Manhattan since the last time I was here. Off the desert floor, like flowers after a flash flood, they had sprouted a skyline of glass and steel skyscrapers, all air-conditioned, all lit up at night, just like ours." I went on to Iraq, came home, kissed my wife, changed clothes, flew off to Dalian, China. Another city you may have never heard of. Dalian is a port city in northeast China, a city I've been a frequent visitor to because it's the outsourcing capital of China, and I spent a lot of time there working on The World is Flat. Hadn't been there in 3 years. Dalian already had a Manhattan. They had sprouted another in the 3 years since I was there. I came home, I said to my wife, I said, "You know, honey, it's wonderful that we and all the neighbors got hybrid cars." Doha and Dalian ate that for breakfast. It's just great that Montgomery County, where we live, has passed a new ordinance on building code installations to enhance energy efficiency. But Doha and Dalian had that for lunch. I am thrilled that all of you here in Marin County have gotten rid of your incandescent light bulbs and replaced them with CFLs. Doha and Dalian, two cities you have never heard of, we'll snack on that before dinner like so much popcorn. That's what's happening as flat is meeting crowded. I have a friend, Tom Burke. He runs a wonderful NGO from Great Britain. And Tom invented, it's in the book, a new unit of measure. And he calls it the Americum. And Americum is any 300 million people living like Americans. When I was born in 1953, there were 2.5 Americums in the world: the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. Today, there are 9 Americums in the world. There's America, there's Western Europe, there's Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and Russia, there's Japan and East Asia, there's an Americum in India, giving birth to another, an Americum in China, giving birth to another. We've gone from a world of 2.5 Americums, units of 300 million people living like Americans, to a world of 9 Americums in the space of 30 years. So that's really what energy is driving: energy and natural resource supply and demand. Demand for food, fuel, steel, cement, timber, and water. That's our first, I think, mega problem. Go to the next slide, please. The next issue is petrodictatorship. That's the rise of the Putins, the Chavezes, the Ahmadinejads in Iran, all these regimes that basically depend on oil for their power and influence in the world today. They aren't making microchips. They've gotten strong purely on the back of $150 barrel oil. Now, what I did was, to illustrate the implications of this, I created this graph. It started on the back of an envelope, actually. The thick black line at the bottom, the one that just looks like a wide V, is actually the price of oil. What I did was I graphed the price of oil from 1979 until 2006. And if you graph the price of oil from 79 to 2006, in round numbers, what it looks like is $80, that's cut in 1979, falls down to, $16 in 1995, and goes back to $80 in 2005. It's not current, totally up to date. So it goes from $80 to, it actually goes down to $10 close to $10 in 1991. What happened in 1991? Oh, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990. Oh, must have been an accident. So down to $10 in 1991 and then back to $80 in 2005. Then what I did is I went to Freedom House and I got the Freedom House Freedom Index for four countries. Freedom House does a freedom index. They measure free and fair elections held, new political parties opened or closed, newspapers and magazines started or closed, NGOs and women's groups begun. They call it the Freedom Index. I got the Freedom Index for four petrolist states, states that are almost totally dependent on oil for their GDP, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, and Nigeria. And I actually do each one individually in the book. But if you put them all together, what you would do, what it would look like, is that top line, the Freedom Index. And what I did was I just overlaid the Freedom Index on the price of oil index. So the price of oil is the bottom line, and the Freedom Index for those four countries is the top line. Well, isn't that kind of interesting? That looks like the price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation in petrolist states. States dependent on oil for their GDP. As the price of oil went down, the pace of freedom went up. As the price of oil went up, the pace of freedom went down. You don't need my graph, though, to know this. You actually all know this from reading the newspapers. After all, it was 5 years ago when oil was $30 a barrel or thereabouts that our president, George Bush, looked into Vladimir Putin's soul and came back and reported that he saw a good man down there. If you look in Putin's soul today, you will see Gazprom, Lukos, Izvestia, Pravda, the Russian parliament, and lately Georgia, all of which he has devoured courtesy of $147 a barrel oil at its peak. When oil was $15 a barrel, exactly $15 a barrel, Iran elected Mohammad Khatami as its president. He called for a dialogue of civilizations. At $75 a barrel, the day he was elected, Iran elected Ahmadinejad, and he says the Holocaust is a myth. I have a corollary to the, I call this graph the first law of petropolitics. The price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation. I have a corollary to the first law of petropolitics, and it says that the Holocaust is never a myth at $15 a barrel. It's only a myth at $75 a barrel or above. So that's what is being driven. That's the impact in geopolitics of a world that's hot, flat, and crowded. So a third issue is climate change. I actually call that chapter in the book global weirding, because we're not going to have global warming. To say global warming to a kid from Minnesota, that sounds like golf in December. Okay, that does not sound bad to me at all. Okay, we're not going to have global warming. We're going to have something that Hunter Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute coined the term global weirding. Because actually what happens when the climate changes is that the weather gets weird. The weather gets weird. The hots get hotter. The dries get longer. The droughts get more severe. The wets get wetter. The snows get thicker. The most violent hurricanes are likely to become more frequent. That's actually what climate change represents. Now, I'm not a climate scientist, so what interests me and what I explore in this chapter most is really the philosophical issues raised by climate change. And that's why the chapter begins with two questions: who's making it hot, and doesn't Al Gore really owe us all a big apology? So what's that about? Well, who's making it hot grew out of a dialogue. I had a lengthy dialogue with one of my great tutors, Professor Nate Lewis, one of the great energy chemists at Caltech, who I was just with this week. And we were having lunch one day at the Caltech Faculty Club, sipping the pink lemonade, especially the house. And it was after Katrina, and I said to Nate, "Nate, what was it about Katrina that so got to us?" And Nate thought about that for a second, and he said, "Who made it hot?" And at first I didn't know what he was getting at, and then I realized. What Nate was saying is that we humans have introduced so much CO2 into Mother Nature's operating system that we no longer know who's really making it hot. Did we make Katrina, or did he make Katrina? Are we making it hot, or is she making it hot? We don't know anymore. You know, when you go to your home insurance policy and you look on there in the page, there's this asterisk, and you go to the bottom of the page to the key, and it says, "Except in the event of acts of God." Your house is insured except in the event of acts of God. Well, we've introduced so much CO2 into Mother Nature's operating system, we don't know anymore. What is an act of God and what is an act of man? Are we making it hot or is she making it hot? Because we are now playing, as my friend Heidi Cullen, the chief climatologist for the Weather Channel, likes to say, we are playing lead electric guitar in Mother Nature's symphony orchestra. And that brings me to Mr. Gore. Last year at Davos, the Davos World Economic Forum, I had the great thrill. I got to moderate a discussion between Al Gore and Bono. I am talking pay-per-view, okay? It was, and I would have paid to do it. It was great fun. And afterwards, it was fascinating to hear the two of them talk. Afterwards, I was actually going to do another event with the vice president, and along the way, it just sort of popped into my head, and I had the chutzpah to say it. We were riding in this cab, and we were in the back, and I said, Mr. Vice President, I think you need to write a column. And if I may be so bold, I know what the lead should be. I'm sorry. I apologize. I, Al Gore, completely underestimated climate change. Oh, that would get your attention. And that really was the point. You see, while everyone was screaming at Al Gore after he came out with An Inconvenient Truth, all these climate deniers and climate skeptics. And by the way, as my friend Joe Rahm says, there's many good things about improved health care, but the best is that all the climate deniers are going to live long enough to see how wrong they were. Okay. While all these climate deniers and skeptics were yelling at Al Gore, telling him how wrong he was, all the climate models were leaping way ahead of even Al Gore. When the IPCC UN climate study came out, first said, all the sea ice in the Arctic will be melted in summer by around 2050. Then they moved it up to 2040, then to 2030. Last report, a couple months ago, 2012. You will be able to sail right across the Arctic in July in 2012 and never meet a piece of ice. The implications of that will be enormous because when you lose the reflectivity of the ice, those sun rays hit the water, they warm the water more, there are huge ocean currents that go through those areas. We have no idea what the positive feedback loops from that can be. And the most thing you need to know about positive feedback loop is they are completely misnamed. They are anything but positive. Okay. So there's Greenland. That's ice melt in Greenland 1992. That's ice melt 2002. I was just in Greenland about 2 months ago with Denmark's Minister of Climate. We went way up north to an ice core sample station. Greenland last summer, 2007, through melt and breakage from its ice cap, lost the same twice the amount of ice that exists in all the European Alps in one summer, okay, or in 1 year. It rained. Ilulissat, major city in Greenland on the west coast, it rained last Christmas in Ilulissat. It didn't snow. It rained. It doesn't rain in Ilulissat at Christmas. So while everyone's been screaming at Al Gore, actually, the climate models have leapt way ahead. See, the climate deniers have been kind of telling us, well, look, we're playing with dice. The dice can only come up 2 and 12. Gore thinks it's 12. We think it's 2. No, no, no. These are polyhedral dice, like in Dungeons and Dragons. They can come up 2 and 12, 2 and 20, 2 and 40, 2 and 60, 2 and 80. We have no idea what the outside boundary is once the climate system starts changing. And hence, to draw attention to that, my tongue-in-cheek suggestion to the vice president was that he should write a column saying, I'm really sorry, I completely underestimated climate change. It's going to be so much more powerful than you realize.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU FM.
Fourth issue is energy poverty. Energy poverty is the chapter is called the 1.6 billion. It's about the 1.6 billion people on the planet who have no on-off switch in their life. That's right. One out of four people on this planet, which is more than one out of four actually, have no connection to electric grid. They have no on-off switch in their life. And to be energy poor in a world that's hot, flat, and crowded is going to be really, really terrifying. You will not have the electricity to drill a deeper well when the hot gets hotter. You will not have the electricity to buy even the most simple fan when the dry gets longer. And most importantly, you will not have the electricity to get to Google. And if you cannot get to Google, you cannot get to all the world's knowledge. You cannot get to the 99 things everyone knows in order to invent the one that they don't know. And if you can't know the 99 things people know, all you will do is recreate them. You will never invent the one they don't. And so not having electricity means not being able to get to Google. That's so much worse than not being able to get to a library. It means you cannot get to all the world's knowledge. It means you will fall behind exponentially, not just arithmetically. Last year, all of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, generated about 1 new gigawatt of electric power. That's 1 billion watts. China generates 1 new gigawatt about every 2 weeks. So China today is generating in new electric power every 2 weeks exactly what all of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, is generating in a year. That's what energy poverty is all about. Fifth issue is biodiversity loss. I call that chapter the Age of Noah, because we are in the middle of a mass extinction in a world that's hot, flat, and crowded of biodiversity. We are, according to Conservation International, losing 1 new species now every 20 minutes because of the rapid rate of development in a world that's hot, flat, and crowded. As John Holdren says, it's as if we were burning down our greatest libraries before we'd even catalog the books. Or as E.O. Wilson said, it's like burning all the pictures in the Louvre just to have dinner. There is a mass extinction phase that we are in the middle of right now, almost equal to when the asteroid hit the dinosaurs. Only this time, we are the asteroid. I call the chapter The Age of Noah because it begins in 2 Chinese zoos where the last 2 giant soft-shelled turtles are being kept alive. One is 100 years old, one is 80 years old. One is a male, one is a female. And they're trying to get them to mate. Not so easy, thanks so much. They're into artificial insemination now. Those two turtles, freshwater turtles, in my view, symbolize the incredible biodiversity challenge of our generation. We are the first generation of humans that is going to have to think like Noah. We are actually the first generation, and particularly our kids, who will actually have to have a strategy for saving the last 2 pair of more and more species. Because we, and particularly our kids, are actually going to meet more and more of the last 2 pair. We are today in the age of Noah. So those for me are the big 5 problems driven by a world getting hot, flat, and crowded. Now there's 2 ways to look at a list like that. One is to look at that list and say, we are so cooked. We are so fried. That's not how I look at it. I look at that list the way John Gardner of Common Cause once described. I look at that list as a series of incredible opportunities masquerading as insoluble problems. Because what's really cool about that list is that they all have, all 5 problems, have the same solution. Abundant, cheap, clean, reliable electrons and molecules. That is, whichever community, company, or country can come up with a source through innovation, energy efficiency, and conservation of abundant, cheap, clean, reliable electrons and molecules will actually be able to dramatically ease energy and natural resource supply and demand, undermine petrodictatorship, mitigate climate change, tremendously relieve energy poverty, and end biodiversity loss. Well, what does that say to me? That says to me that the next great global industry will be the search for abundant, cheap, clean, reliable electrons. I call that industry ET, energy technology. And it is very clear to me that the country that owns ET is going to have the most energy security, national security, economic security, competitive industries, healthy climate, and global respect. That country has to be the United States of America. If it is not, the chance of our kids enjoying our standard of living, I believe, is zero. Because that industry is going to be the biggest industry in a world that's hot, flat, and crowded with those five problems. And as Jeff Immelt from GE likes to say, says to me in the book, Tom, if you want to be big in today's world, as a company, a country, or community, if you want to be big, you got to be big in big things. And ET is going to be the biggest thing. Well, what that means is we have to redefine green. You got to get all this old Birkenstock and sandals and all this other crap out of your head, okay? Green is not about electric power or purely environmentalism. It's now about national power. Because the greenest country is going to own ET. And the country that owns ET is going to be the country with the most energy security, economic security, and I think national security. Now, I'm a big believer in what I do, that to name something is to own it. If you can name an issue, you can own the issue. And what this book is trying to do is to rename green. Because the people who named green historically were actually its opponents. They are the ones who owned the definition. They named it liberal, tree-hugging, sissy, girly man, unpatriotic, vaguely European. Vaguely European. Mr. Gore, you're looking a little European, okay? Well, I'm here to tell you that green is geostrategic, geoeconomic, capitalistic, patriotic. Green is the new red, white, and blue. That's what it is. So get all that old nonsense out of your head. And that's why this book avowedly and proudly speaks out of two sides of its mouth, okay? To Rush Limbaugh, I say, Rush, I have a plan to make America stronger. And by the way, as a byproduct of that plan, we're going to take care of every one of Al Gore's concerns. And to Greens, I say, I have a plan to make America greener. And by the way, as a byproduct of that, we're going to take care of every one of Dick Cheney's concerns. Because this is about national power, not just electric power. And if you don't have scale, if you can't define the problem in a way that people from left and right, conservative and liberal, green and not traditional green, can sign on and be a part of it. If you do not have scale, excuse me, you have a hobby. I like hobbies. I used to build model airplanes. I don't try to change the weather as a hobby. So that's a little of the method to this madness. That is why we need a green revolution, and that's why it can renew America. Now, once again, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but Mr. Friedman, we live out here in Marin County. We're having a green revolution. We're having a green revolution. I love to hear it. I read about it in the United Sky Miles magazine. We're having a green revolution. I always love when people tell me that. I say, really? Really, a green revolution? Us? A green revolution? Have you ever been to a revolution where no one got hurt? That's the green revolution. Yeah, that's the green revolution we're having. In the green revolution we're having, everybody's a winner. Yeah, Exxon's green. I read it on their ad today in the op-ed page of the New York Times. BP's green. They now stand for Beyond Petroleum. GM's now green. They have a little yellow cap they put on their flex fuel Hummer now. Yeah. We're all green, okay, folks? Well, that's actually not a revolution. That's a party. We're having a green party. And I have to tell you, it is so much fun because I get invited to all the parties. But it has no connection whatsoever with a revolution. You'll know this is a revolution when somebody gets hurt. Oh, I don't mean physically. I mean, I read a history of the IT revolution. It was called The World is Flat. And in that revolution, there was just one rule. Change or die. Change or die, baby. That's all there is out there. There's a whole group of companies out there called DEC, Data General, Burroughs. They're not with us anymore. They're in that great IT heaven in the sky. Because they did not change, and so they died. The rule of the green revolution so far is change your brand or die. Somebody give me a green racing stripe. Somebody change the texture of our stationery. No, you'll know this is a real revolution when the word green disappears. There'll be no such thing as a green building. There'll just be a building, and you will not have a choice but to build it to the highest LEED standards. There will be no such thing as a green car. There'll just be a car, and it will be built at the highest efficiency and mileage standards. So you'll pardon me if I get a little testy when people tell me that we're having a green revolution. Now, as I mentioned, people send me stuff all the time, and they also know that I'm a golfer. So one of the things that someone sent me when I was working on the book was from the internet. It said a recent study found the average American golfer walks about 900 miles a year. Another study found American golfers drink, on average, 22 gallons of alcohol a year. That means that, on average, American golfers now get about 41 miles to the gallon. Kind of makes you proud. Okay. Now, when I was working on the book, I was in my doctor's office one day, and a magazine headline caught my cover story. It's not a magazine. I usually read it. Working Mother magazine, I confess. And the cover essay was called 205 Easy Ways to Save the Earth. I saw that, and I thought, so easy. I must look for more. So I went home, went to Google, put in Easy Ways to Save the Earth, and this is just a sample of the book and magazine titles that came up. 20 Easy Ways You Can Help the Earth. Easy Ways to Protect Our Planet. Simple Ways to Save the Earth. 10 Ways to Save the Earth. 20 Quick and Easy Ways to Save the Planet. 5 Ways to Save the Earth. The 10 Easiest Ways You Can Green Your Home. 365 Ways to Save the Earth. 100 Ways You Can Save the Earth. 1,001 Ways to Save the Earth. 101 Ways to Heal the Earth. 10 Painless Ways to Save the Planet. 21 Ways to Save the Earth and Make More Money. 14 Easy Ways to Be an Everyday Environmentalist. Easy Ways to Go Green. 40 Easy Ways to Save the Planet. 10 Simple Ways to Save the Earth. Help Save the Planet. Easy Ways to Make a Difference. 50 Ways to Save the Earth. 50 Simple Ways to Save the Earth and Get Rich Trying. Top 10 Ways to Green Up Your Sex Life. Okay. Vegan Condoms and Solar Vibrators. I'm not making this up. Okay. Innovative Ways to Save Planet Earth, 101 Things Designers Can Do to Save the Earth, 5 Weird and Wacky Ways to Save the Earth, 5 Ways to Save the World, and for those with a messianic streak but who are short of both cash and time, 10 Ways to Save the Earth and Money in Under a Minute. That, friends, is not a revolution. That's a party. We're having a green party. There's one word you should never, ever use when it comes to the green revolution, and that is easy. Because this is the biggest industrial project mankind will ever be asked to take on. It'll be, if we pull it off, the biggest industrial project since the Tower of Babel. And there will be nothing easy about it. How do we do it? Very quickly, I'm a big believer in the market. This is not a problem. We are going to regulate our way out of it. I'm not opposed to Kyoto. If you can get 190 countries around the world to all agree on verifiable limits and reductions to their CO2 emissions, may God bless you and keep you. I don't believe that's going to happen. And therefore, my whole focus is not on regulation, but on innovation. How do we stimulate massive innovation around ET, energy technology, so we get 100,000 innovators in 100,000 garages trying 100,000 things, 1,000 of which will be promising, 100 of which will be way cool, and 2 of which will be the next green Microsoft and green Google. I believe that's how we get out of this problem. How do you do that? To do that, you have to reshape the market. You have got to have the right price signals in place. That means a gasoline or carbon tax that makes dirty fuels more expensive, and incentives and investment tax credits that make renewable energy cheaper. Without the right price signals in place, you will not get innovation at scale. Well, you'll get a lot of people trying a lot of little things, but it will not be at scale. And that brings me back to the government. The government, in my view, has one job here. I don't believe in Manhattan projects. 12 people are not going to go off to Los Alamos and figure this out. I believe in reshaping the market so you get massive innovation, a true green bubble. Now, if you take nothing else away from this lecture, take this. ET is different from IT in one fundamental respect, and this is why you need government, and this is why my mantra is change your leaders, not your light bulbs. ET is different from IT because IT was able to emerge on a green field. When Marc Andreessen invented the Netscape browser, there were not three browsers out there, cheaper and dirtier, that he had to compete with. That is not true with ET. ET always has to compete against existing cheap alternatives that provide the same function. Let me give you a simple example that my friend Nate Lewis taught me that can really illustrate this point. Let's say I invented the world's first cell phone. And I came to my friend Elaine at Book Passage, and I said, Elaine, I have a phone you can carry in your pocket. She'd say, Tom, a phone I could carry in my pocket? That would give me a whole new function I've never had. That would change my life. I could get complaints from customers 24 hours a day. They could call me at home and late and early. Tom, that would change my life. A phone I can carry in my pocket, I'll take 10. I said, wait a minute, Elaine. Wait a minute, darling. These phones, they cost $1,000 each. She'd say, Tom, no problem. A phone I could carry in my pocket would change my life. I'll take 10. Sell 10 to Elaine, 10 to you, 10 to you, 10 to her, 10 to him. But you know what happens. 6 months later, I'm back. The phone's only $50, weighs half as much, because I'm down the cost-volume curve heading for the China price, the price at which my phone will scale in India and China. Oh, I love Book Passage. I love Elaine. Year later, come back. Call my friend Elaine. Elaine, got another deal for you now. How did that phone work out for you, Elaine? Oh, Tom, that phone changed my life. Got another deal for you. See the lights here at Book Passage, Elaine? I'm going to power these lights with solar energy. But it's going to cost you $100 more a month. What would my friend Elaine say? My friend Elaine would say, Tom, remember that phone you sold me? That changed my life. In case you haven't noticed, we at Book Passage, we already have lights. And we really don't care where the electrons come from. And I got Barnes & Noble down in the next mall. I just can't afford $100 more a light. So unless the government comes along and says to my friend Elaine, Elaine, from now on, you're going to pay $150 more for those lights. You're going to pay for the cost of the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere, putting on our kids' Visa cards. You're going to pay for the cost of the troops protecting the oil from the Persian Gulf. You're going to pay the fully burdened cost of those lights. When that happens, my friend Elaine gets on that little cell phone I sold her, which is now only $50, and she says, Tom, those solar lights, I'll take 10. And then I'm down the cost-volume curve heading for the China price. Without that price signal, it will not happen at scale. It would be as if you were trying to get funding for the NASA Apollo space program to put a man on the moon when Southwest Airlines already flies to the moon. Do you believe for 1 second we ever would have gotten funding for the Apollo space program if Southwest Airlines already flew to the moon and gave away free peanuts? I don't think so. And you are not going to get massive investment in renewable energy as long as wind, solar, geothermal, and all the rest of them have to compete against existing cheap, dirty alternatives. And that's why Jeff Immelt, the head of GE, says, Tom, I am not going to make a 40-year, multi-billion-dollar bet on a 15-minute price signal. I just saw oil go from 147 to 87 to 107 to 57 to 65. And if you think I'm going to make a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar bet with that price signal oscillating like that, my shareholders would have no mercy on me. Without a fixed, durable, long-term price signal, you will not get innovation at scale. And any candidate who tells you otherwise is blowing smoke. And that brings me to my conclusion, and it gets us back to government. I was doing a management seminar with Mr. Immelt last year. And at one point, and Jeff's a great guy, he threw up his hands and simply said, Tom, we need a president who is going to set the right carbon price, set the right standards and regulations, to stimulate innovation around clean power. And then get out of the way. Everyone will moan and cry for a month, and then the whole American ecosystem of innovation will adapt and take off. I thought about that afterwards, and I called him. I said, Jeff, what you're really saying is if only we could be China for a day. Just one day. Would it be so bad? So the penultimate chapter of this book is called China for a Day, but Not for Two. China for a Day, but Not for Two. And it's my fantasy of what it would be like if we could actually be China for a day and have a government that could actually order things from the top down and lay the framework and groundwork for a real ET revolution. But of course, I love China, love the Chinese people, but we can't be China for a day, and I don't want to be China for a day. And that leads to the last chapter. If you would slowly go through the slides, we're going to go all the way to the end. There's just one I want to get to. Just flip through them, and I'll tell you when to stop. Yeah, keep going, just keep going. Just keep going if you can. Oh, that's okay. Stop. Yeah, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Oh, then my favorite quote in the book. When we leave Iraq, it will be the biggest transfer of air conditioners ever known to mankind. That's actually my favorite quote in the book. It's from Dan Nolan, the head of the Army's power team. Now go to the last slide, please. The last chapter of the book is, because we can't be China for a day, and I don't want to be China for a day, the last chapter is called A Democratic China or a Banana Republic. Because I believe that's really what our choices are. We are either going to get our government to work so it can democratically, through our system, generate the will, focus, authority, direction, and stick-to-itiveness to launch a real ET revolution, a real ET revolution, or we're going to be a banana republic. Oh, no, not the Latin American kind. No. The way they use the term banana in the utility business, you've heard of NIMBY, not in my backyard. Well, people in the utility business use the acronym BANANA, Build Absolutely Nothing Anywhere Near Anything. We are either going to be a democratic China, or when it comes to renewable energy and clean power, we are going to build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. Now, I don't want to leave you and Elaine on a downer note. On pessimism. So, I don't do pessimism well. Pessimists are usually right. Optimists are usually wrong, but all the great change in history was done by optimists, so I'm going to throw in my lot with them. Let me close by sharing with you, really, from the last page of the book. This book actually ends on a eulogy, but it's not a downer. It's a beautiful eulogy that was written by Amory Lovins, the great environmentalist, for another great environmentalist, Dana Meadows, who taught many, many of the leaders of today's environmental movement, and she was a professor at Dartmouth. She died in 2001, and on February 21st, 2001, at her memorial service, this was Amory Lovins' eulogy. A biologist, perhaps E.O. Wilson, noted that bees, ants, and termites, though not very smart individually, display high intelligence collectively. And then he added, people seem just the opposite. Dana Meadows was an exception. She was one of those promising specimens that are turning up more and more often in the search for intelligent life on Earth. One of those much higher primates whose love, logic, radical stubbornness, courage, and passion awaken the rest of us to our ability and our responsibility to save the world. She wrote 3 years ago, by nature I'm an optimist. To me all glasses are half full. Yet she didn't shrink from reporting bad news, always blended with encouragement about how to do better. She treated the future as choice, not fate, and she defined with luminous clarity how to do as one sometimes must, what is necessary. She shared René Dubois' view that despair is a sin, so when asked if we have enough time to prevent catastrophe, she'd always say, we have exactly enough time, starting now. 2 years ago, when emailing an unusually somber column about events that made her weep, she added the following note as counterpoint. A CEO was having to babysit for his young daughter. He was trying to read the paper, but was totally frustrated by the constant interruptions. When he came across a full-page picture of the NASA photo of the Earth from space, he got a brilliant idea. He ripped it up into small pieces and told his child to try to put it back together. He then settled in for what he expected to be a good half hour of peace and quiet. But only a few minutes went by before the child appeared at his side with a big grin on her face. "You finished already?" he asked. "Yes," she replied. "How did you do it?" "Well, I saw that there was a picture of a person on the other side. So when I put the person together, the earth got put together too." There is so much to admire in that eulogy, the conviction that the future is our choice, not our fate, that when you put people together, you put the planet together, and that there is nothing in the universe quite as powerful as 6 billion minds wrapping around one problem. And most of all, the best expression of sober optimism I've ever heard: we have exactly enough time, starting now. Friends, this is, I think, the most critical election in our lifetime. We are in a really, really serious moment. And it's a testing time, even for an optimist like me. The hour is really late. We need to get to work, back to work, on our country and on our planet. The stakes could not be higher. The project could not be harder. The payoff could not be greater. And we have exactly enough time, starting now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If you want to find out more about Thomas L. Friedman, and I suggest that you do, just go to www.thomaslfriedman.com. It'll take you right to his webpage. And I strongly recommend that you read his previous book to this, The World is Flat. It will help you to understand the current circumstances of our global planet and make things a lot easier to deal with. That's it for today's show. I'm your host, Maggie Hughes, and thanks once again for listening.